This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Hi, I'm Jamie Bussin. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll discuss joint health for your dog with nutraceutical formulator Dr. Gordon Chang. We'll learn how to overcome a crisis with mindfulness expert and author Marcy Westcott. We'll find out about RSV risks for adults with infectious disease specialist Dr. Zane Chagla. And lastly, we'll discover the dangers of missing the warning signs of reproductive cancer with surgeon scientist Dr. Jessica McAlpin. Before we get to that, here's your tonic quick shot. A new study from Imperial College London suggests that medical cannabis may help improve sleep quality in people with insomnia. The research, published in PLOS Mental Health, followed 124 patients who used cannabis-based medical products for up to 18 months. Insomnia affects many people. About 1 in 3 have trouble sleeping, and 10% of adults have a serious sleep disorder. Traditional treatments can be hard to get, and some sleeping pills can cause dependence. This study looked at how cannabis-based products affect sleep, anxiety, depression, and pain. Patients reported better sleep, less anxiety and depression, and reduced pain. These improvements lasted through the 18-month period. Only about 9% of the people had side effects like dry mouth or tiredness, but none were serious. Dr. Simon Erridge, a co-author of the study, said that medical cannabis could be a good option when other treatments don't work. However, he also said more research is needed to prove its long-term safety and effectiveness. This study offers real-world evidence, but doctors should continue to watch patients closely and create personalized treatment plans. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: The Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. I'll be joined by Dr. Gordon Chang in a moment, but first, a little bit of business. I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com. Omega Alpha's products are created by their scientific team headed by their owner, operator, and CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Dr. Chang holds a PhD in physiology and biomedical engineering from the University of Toronto. He also has 2 years postdoctoral experience in clinical biochemistry, looking at free radicals and antioxidants. He's published over 20 peer-reviewed articles and conference proceedings, and he's a frequent guest on the show. Welcome back, Gordon.
Thank you, Jamie, once again for having me on your show.
I'm excited about this discussion today, Gordon. You know, from time to time, we've talked about my dog, Ellie, who's an Aussie doodle and who was an absolute maniac. Aussies are the breed, you know, that you can see jumping like feet into the air to catch frisbees. And, you know, they do the agility training and they chase balls endlessly. And she was a maniac puppy and young dog, but she's going to be 9 years old in a few weeks and she's moving differently. So today's discussion is apropos. We're going to be speaking about joint health for pets. And your focus is for dogs and cats, which I know your company has created unique formulations for pet joint health. So that's good. There seems to be some confusion, though, on the types of pet supplement ingredients, when to start using supplementation, and safety with food choices. I know you're always about prevention, and I'm hoping you can break it down for us today. Sound like a plan?
Sounds like a plan. You know, this topic came about because I was having lunch with one of my colleagues, and she has a bunch of dogs. And one of the things she said to me was, "You know, my dogs don't realize that they're old. They still whip around like maniacs, right?" That was, and I said, "You know, that is great when your dog is a pup, right? But as they get older, you know, it's like us. As we get older, if we try to do the same things that we were doing when we were younger, things happen. You know, we sprain things, we break things, et cetera, right?"
I do.
So then I said, "Hey, you know what? These dogs behave like weekend warriors that don't realize that they're weekend warriors." But after having said that, it's very, you can't sit the dog down and say, "Hey, behave yourself. Don't run around like a maniac," because you know they don't understand. They just, if they're feeling good, they do what comes natural, which is, in the case of your dog, is like a maniac running circles around you, right?
Exactly.
So one of the things I was saying is, since we can't talk to them on a cognitive level, we can't like reason with them, right? We have to do the best that we can, and the best that we can is prevention. Things that we should be doing is increasing the thickness of the ligaments and the sinews, right? Because you know, if you have collagen is one of the key ingredients, right? Of building up the ligaments and so on, right? You got to give them the right minerals to help strengthen the bones, right? You got to give them things which are anti-inflammatory, so that even if they have what I call minor inflammations, the anti-inflammatories keep that under check, and if it keeps it under check, it helps prevent major damage to the tissue, right? Also, as your dog gets older, as you said in the opening statements, is that your dog does not move like the way he used to when he was a lot younger, right? And from that, I took it to mean that your dog is a little bit slower, right? He's a little bit more ouchy. So, you know, there are things that we can do for helping with the ouchiness, etc.
It kind of manifests in different ways, right? Like, when they jump into the car, she's a little reticent now. She's not sure if she's going to make that jump. Or, when she gets the zoomies now and she's leaping over the furniture, I notice, the leaps aren't quite as long as they were before, and she just gets tired more easily. She just does, you know?
Yeah, that is true. So there are things that we can do to help, right? And there are things we can. I would love to, I like to say prevention, but you know, as I'm getting older too, there's only so much prevention that we can prevent, right? And especially with a dog, you can't tell. Don't whip around like a maniac, right? They're not going to listen. They don't even know about that. They only have one speed, which is top speed, and maniac speed. Right. So what we could do with them, as I said, you know, we give them something that's glucosamine, chondroitin. Those are what I call the building blocks that you can use for building stronger joints. But a lot of people stop there. They don't go any further than glucosamine and chondroitin. Right. What people don't realize is that if you want to strengthen the joints, glucosamine and chondroitin is a building block, but you still need to give them the minerals. Because what the minerals do is strengthen the joints, strengthen the ligaments, and also the minerals also enhance the activity of the enzymes that are used to build the joints and the ligaments, right? And to build. So what kind of minerals are we talking about here? Usually the first ones, when we talk about joints, we're talking about the big ones, which is calcium and magnesium. But what people also don't realize, you need things like silicon. You need things like manganese. You need things like copper, right? And there's a slew of other little, what I call trace minerals that you also need, right? To help build strong joints. And a lot of these minerals serve two purposes. One of them, they serve to build a lattice work where the bones get strengthened, right? So they're also building components, but you also need them to pop. There are cofactors in the activity of the enzyme systems that are used to make new joint tissue or make or strengthen the ligament tissue or strengthen the muscles, right? In addition to that, you also need to use some B vitamins, because the B vitamins are also one of the things that will help It's one of the things that will create more ATP to power the biochemistry that the energy is needed to build a lot of these tissues. All right. Now, after even with all that, we have to look at the breakdown side of things. So the breakdown side of things is that if you have a dog that runs like a maniac, you know he's going to be tearing muscles, right? And if you tear muscle, you're going to have breakdown of muscle tissue. You're going to have inflammation. The thing with inflammation is a necessary evil, but inflammation that's gone haywire is a bad thing, right? So you need to control the inflammation. And the best way to control the inflammation, there are a lot of herbs out there that people have used to help with inflammation. Things like turmeric would be effective, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the one that comes very quickly to my mind. Any type of antioxidants also work. So things like boswellia also works with that. So, you know, I know with the feeding of your pets these days, a lot of people make their own food. All right. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to make your own food, you need to enhance your food by adding some trace minerals and so on to the food so that your dog gets as much nutrients as humanly possible. Right. Unfortunately, dogs are not like people in the sense that we choose whatever food we want to eat.
Right.
With the dogs will look at you and beg for food. But a lot of times we've been conditioned not to feed them everything and anything.
I'm a soft touch though, Gordon. I'm the weak link. So she's tremendous. Ellie is a tremendous beggar. Anyways, carry on.
Yeah, but you know you're not supposed to give them that much sugar, right?
No, not sugar.
But invariably when they see you eating the piece of cake, that's what they want, right? They're not looking for the healthy treats, right?
Yeah.
One of the things with treats I know is that there's a lot of sugars and so on in them. But I would say you have to give them a treat every so often because that's what makes life worth living to.
Oh, 100%. Right? No. Yeah. I'm displacing my desire to eat and she gets to eat what I don't get to eat. But, you know, we try, if we're giving her table scraps, it's usually protein or vegetables. So.
Right. And vegetables, you know, we call that table scraps. So vegetables for dogs are very good because it's a source of a lot of antioxidants.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. I am one of those people that believe that you have to have a wide variety of antioxidants in your food.
Right.
Because antioxidants are anti-inflammatory by nature to start off with. Right. So the bigger the variety you have, the better. Is your, I call it your anti-inflammatory shield to help protect your breakdown of joints and muscle, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but unfortunately, I know a lot of people just feed their dog kibble, right? And I'm not making judgments or so. It's just that sometimes I know kibble is convenient, right? So that's why people do the kibble. But you can enhance your kibble by adding nutrients to the kibble. Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so there are things like we make a very good product called Nutrify, which you can add to your kibble, which enhances the effects of the increases the nutrient value of whatever it is you're going to be feeding. And when I talk nutrient values, I'm not talking about protein, because usually a lot of the kibbles or whatever food you give your dog has a specified amount of protein, carbs, and fat. Those are usually well thought out by the pet food manufacturer.
Right.
Where the problem is in the things like the B vitamins, the trace minerals, you know, things like your selenium, your zinc, your copper. A lot of times, a lot of the foods are deficient in those things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And even sometimes we talk about things like vegetables or even probiotics. A lot of that, if it's in the kibble, is usually the processing destroys a lot of those things. So you, in effect, not getting much value for those. So it's usually a good thing to add back to your kibble, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I digress because we were talking about joints here, right?
Yeah.
So the nice thing of joints and prevention is that if you take your preventative measures, you can help increase the strength of your joints. And now I'm not going to ever say to you that if you take this, your dog is never going to have a joint problem. Because you know as well as I do, it just depends on how rambunctious your dog is.
Right.
One day he's looking good, next day he goes and he takes a 90 degree turn as if he was driving a race car, and next thing you know, he pops the ACL or something like that. God forbid, but I have known this and I've seen this happen many a time. All right. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say many a time, but I've seen it happen. I know of it happening. All right. So, but what you do is it's like prevention is one of those things you do to help mitigate it happening as frequent as you would expect. So it lessens the chances of it happening.
If that's so, when should we start thinking about the dose of prevention and using supplementation?
I would start as young as possible. All right.
Okay.
I would say go out today and get something that has all these trace nutrients, etc., in there. All right.
Mm-hmm.
And add back to your food. All right. I know some people will say, oh, my dog is 2 years old, he doesn't need glucosamine, etc. That is true. He may not need glucosamine at that age. However, 2 years to when he hits 5, 6, that is middle age for dogs a lot of time, 5, 6 years old, right? Because
mm-hmm.
if you do the math, is what you say, one human year is 7 dog years. So if you have a dog that's 5 years old times 7, that's 35 years, right? We're starting to get into middle age there for humans, right?
Yeah.
And what people should also realize, dogs are like people too. We have the same basic biochemistry, right? We have the same basic physiology. So just as we as people get older, same thing happens to dogs. Just as our muscles get weaker, same thing happens to dogs. This is why your dog is 9 years old. If you do that in human years, that's 63 years old. And you know at 63, right, much as you'd like to say, I can run the marathon, unless you've been training specifically for that, it ain't going to happen. Right. And you know, a lot of dogs, this is what we call the weekend warrior syndrome. At 63, they think they can do it all. And this is where injuries happen.
Yeah. No, that makes total sense. So let's talk, let's focus a little bit on the products because we only have a few minutes left. In your view, which is more effective, liquid or powders?
Liquids are always better than powders. Okay. Because liquids, the absorption rate of liquids is a lot faster and it's more efficient, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes you got to use powders because you are incorporating a wide variety of things, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We have this particular powder called Sinupet, which has glucosamine, MSM, the whole nine yards, but it also has the trace minerals. It also has the antioxidants, right? The anti-inflammatories. And it has a whole bunch of different things in there that you would want to use, right? Now, today we're just talking about the joints, but, you know, dogs have issues with the gut, et cetera, which is for another day, right?
Yeah.
But in the light of time. But you know, in general, I always prefer to say, take the liquids.
One last question, and that is, if your dog appears to be suffering from joint pain, is there anything we can do to help alleviate that pain?
The glucosamine and chondroitin by itself is not going to do the job. If you want to see fairly quick results, buy a product that has glucosamine, chondroitin, and anti-inflammatory herbs in there.
Okay.
Right? So anything with anti-inflammatory herbs will work.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Well, thank you for having me on again, David.
That was Dr. Gordon Chang. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss overcoming a crisis with mindfulness on The Tonic.
For more than 30 years, Genestra brands have been trusted by health professionals across Canada. Their supplements are supported by scientific research and manufactured to meet high-quality standards. By combining traditional use with modern clinical evidence, Genestra provides professional-grade supplements that support your health. Learn more about their full range of products at genestra.ca.
Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal. Organic or wild-crafted, these oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin.
choose from a wide variety, including Argan, Rosehip, or Skin Lovers Blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Marcy Westcott is a mindfulness teacher, award-winning author of Searching for Sanity, and creator of Soul Legacy Retreats. She's taught internationally at Feast for the Soul and was honored as a 223 NABO Woman Business Owner of the Year finalist and a 2025 NABO Inspiring Woman of the Year award winner. She also offers one-on-one private coaching, helping people transform stress and crisis into clarity and resilience. Her core belief is that anyone can sit down, close their eyes, and access stillness, the doorway to their true inner nature. Welcome to the show, Marcy. How are you?
I'm well, Jamie. Thank you so much for having me.
So we've discussed mindfulness on the show many times, but not necessarily in the context of crisis. So I thought it would be interesting to bring you on the show so you can sort of edify how a mindfulness practice would help you in a time of crisis. And I guess in order to do that, we should probably define what you mean by crisis.
Sure. So crisis would be, you know, taking an event, right, that takes us to an extreme level of emotion, something that comes in from out of left field, you know, some major storm, and absolutely has the potential and probably will just knock the pegs out from underneath us.
And you think mindfulness can help us no matter what form the crisis takes, like whether it's like losing your job or a loved one or, you know, emotional abuse or physical abuse or something along those lines?
I absolutely know that it can, because I have actually lived through that. In 2023, I had a series of crises back to back to back, separated by about 3 weeks, roughly. And had it not been for my mindfulness practices, there's no question I probably would have had a nervous breakdown.
Why do you think it's important to prepare for a crisis before it arrives rather than sort of reacting to one when you're in the midst of it?
Yeah, it's a great question. So most people, you know, really struggle with the day-to-day stress and anxiety, the normal things that we, you know, encounter. But when we are faced with a crisis, which could be something that causes extreme anxiety or grief, it could be an illness or burnout, it could be something spiritual like feeling lonely or disconnected. But this is something that can really take us to, once again, an extreme level of emotion. And that mindfulness enables us to kind of be present in the moment, which is really what mindfulness is. And it helps us put some space between the chaos of that crisis and where we are emotionally.
When people come on the show, they sometimes talk about a mindfulness practice as sort of having like tools, like almost like a toolkit. So it occurs to me that like having the skill set or the tools to deal with something ahead of time, it's almost like preventative medicine. Is that the way you're perceiving it?
It is, although I love to think of it as a way of being rather than a tool we might reach for. That really is what mindfulness and meditation can do for us. And mindfulness and meditation can really be kind of synonymous. So I like to think of it as a state of being, because then we are prepared for anything, regardless of what happens.
So let's talk about what mindfulness is or can be, because, you know, I've come to learn that it's different for different people, right? Like, mindfulness can be as simple as, you know, just being still. What do you think is a basic practice? And can you walk us through for the listeners what that might look like?
Sure. So the definition of mindfulness is paying attention to what you're doing while you're doing it with a non-judgmental attention. And that means without evaluating it or analyzing it. So we don't decide if we like it or we don't like it, it's good or it's bad. It's simply what is. Now, that really coincides with meditation. Meditation is a little bit more formal practice of mindfulness, because we sit down and we close our eyes and we perform that, you know, in a more formal manner. So what I love to use is something called mindfulness in a minute, and it kind of combines these two concepts. It's really easy. It takes about a minute to do. We could walk your listeners through it if you'd like.
Yeah, why don't we do that?
Okay, go ahead and get comfortable where you're seated. Allow your eyes to gently float closed. And bring your attention to your breath. We're not changing the rhythm or the speed or the way that you're breathing. We're simply bringing your full attention to your breath. And with your attention here, we can become more focused in this present moment. And we can set an intention to walk through the world calmly, more present. So when you're ready, when it feels comfortable, you can slowly open your eyes.
You have a very good mindfulness voice. I've been told
Thank you.
That's like a yoga instructor walking around tapping everybody on the head with a little menthol while they're in Shavasana and you know.
So what I would say is this mindfulness in a minute is something that can be extremely valuable,
yep,
regardless of whether you're using it personally or professionally. If you're at work, you can use it before you take a meeting. You can use it before you enter into a conversation. You can use it traveling to or from a place. And it really just helps us to arrive to the moment and not bring the energy of what we came from to where we are now.
Okay. So let's talk about what's actually happening when we have a mindfulness practice. Like, how is it actually moving you from reactivity to sort of being more resilient?
So it's bringing us, when we say bringing us to the present moment, it's letting go of everything that has already happened, not projecting about what is going to happen later, but to be fully present in this moment, because in this moment, this is where our lives are happening, right? And there are all kinds of things that go on in our brain when we're practicing mindfulness and meditation. I think one of the miracles of it is that it actually changes the structure of our brain in healthy, positive ways. So in this case, it could be deactivating emotional centers that might cause us to feel disconnected or lonely, or deactivating the famous amygdala, right, our fight or flight center. Mm-hmm. When it deactivates that, then we become calmer, more present, and we're letting go of stress and anxiety.
Do you think that vulnerability has a role in the healing process? And how can mindfulness help us face our pain without dwelling on it or losing ourselves in it? So how do you become open in that circumstance?
That's such a great question. You know, we can thank Brené Brown for her brilliance, right, in helping us understand vulnerability. But vulnerability really is about courage. It's not about feeling unsafe. And it's really a doorway to how we can heal ourselves. So mindfulness helps us to kind of create a safe container for all of the rawness that stress and anxiety can be, or in this case, you know, if we're talking about a crisis that has blown in. And it kind of helps us not push away the pain, but not to drown in it, to simply be present to it and be able to navigate it in kind of a new way.
If we have a listener who's currently going through a crisis, whatever that may look like, what are first steps in terms of mindfulness that you would recommend?
The first step is to stop and pause. The power of the pause is tremendous. It's profound. It's basically giving our brain kind of a, what we call a pattern interrupt, right? Kind of a do-over. And so we create some space between whatever the stimulus is and then what our response would be. So pausing, and a great way to really come back to being centered in the moment, is to close your eyes and just feel a sense of being grounded. And grounded really means being safe and feeling secure. So ground yourself through your feet, where you might be sitting, and then really start to focus on breathing through your nose slowly and deeply. When we breathe through our nose, it's calming the emotional centers in our brain. And our breath is a great anchor to bring us back to the present moment. Our breath and our body are always right here, right now.
For people who may be waiting for the quote-unquote right time to begin this type of work, what would you tell them?
Well, there's no perfect time, right? Jon Kabat-Zinn, we kind of consider him the godfather of mindfulness. And if you ask him what time it is, he will tell you the time is now. So if we're waiting for the perfect time, you know, we're never going to get out of the driveway. The time is now. So start in this moment. And it's really the best time, you know, trying to face a crisis or navigate a crisis. That's not the best time to try and introduce something new, right? Mm-hmm. So if we can be prepared for that, you know, going into it, the time is now. And I don't think that there's any better or more profound way to say it than that. We can always talk ourselves out of something and put it off. We do that all day long. You know, being in the present moment and practicing mindfulness is something that we can make time for now.
If you had somebody who was consulting with you who was in crisis, though, what would you do for them? If you can't really start, if they're in crisis, like what can you do for them?
Well, we can first talk about what is going on, and then we can simply start the practice. Close our eyes, become still, breathe through our nose, and you know, start to kind of decelerate, right? To not project about whatever future fears are flooding our mind, to become present to the moment by closing our eyes and breathing in and out deeply and slowly. That really is one of the fastest ways that you can do that.
I'm one of those people that can't, like, really struggles to turn the thoughts off, right? So, like, I do this thing. My listeners know they're going to be bored by this, but like after I finish working out, when I'm doing stretches, I find sort of counting out the holding of the stretches is almost like my meditation. But but I also find, you know, like little ideas will sort of pop into my head while I'm trying to keep them out. Do you have any advice for someone like me who really struggles to keep those ideas out?
Yeah, one thing you can try is counting your breaths. You know, what we want to be able to kind of keep the flood of thoughts at bay as best we can, because you're never not going to have thoughts. It's the nature of your mind to think, just like it's the nature of your eyes to see. And I always like to say you can't stop thinking about thinking by not thinking about thinking. The more you try to do that, you know, the more you're probably going to be doing it. And so counting your breaths can be really effective. You close your eyes, you inhale to the count of one, exhale to the count of two, inhale to the count of three, exhale to the count of four. You can go all the way up to 10. If you get to 10, start over again. And what that's doing is it's giving you a point of focus. It's kind of giving your mind something to hold on to when those thoughts start to happen. And when they do happen, and they will, simply realize that it's natural. It doesn't matter how many times you have to come back to what you're focused on. That that continual focusing and refocusing over and over again interrupts your brain's reactivity, and it interrupts the domination of those compulsive thinking patterns.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much, Jamie.
That was Marcy Westcott. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss RSV on The Tonic.
Cataracts are the leading cause of vision loss in adults over 50, but the good news is they're highly treatable. At Oakville Laser Eye Center, patients receive advanced laser cataract surgery with personalized surgeon-led care. Using cutting-edge technology and customized treatment plans, their expert team helps patients see clearly again to help them rediscover life's details. Book your consultation today at www.oakvillelaser.ca or call 905-337-3736.
Convincing yourself it's just another unflattering haircut? Going for a swim and getting a sunburn on your scalp? Miss having bedhead? Ditch the drama and get your hair back so you can stop worrying and start feeling like yourself again. Contact the experts from Form Face and Body. Call 416-447-6176 or visit formfacebody.ca. Stop worrying and start living.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
The Ontario government has announced the respiratory syncytial virus, better known as RSV, vaccine will be covered for all Ontarians over the age of 75, helping to protect this vulnerable group during the upcoming respiratory virus season. While this is welcome news, some might question whether this goes far enough. What other populations are at risk of more severe outcomes from RSV? And for those who can't afford to pay out of pocket for RSV vaccine, what is the potential impact they may face if they contract the virus? Dr. Zane Chagla, co-medical director of infection control at St. Joseph's Healthcare in Hamilton, is here to discuss RSV impact for older adults. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Chagla. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
So for those who don't know, what is RSV and how common is it during fall and winter?
So RSV is a virus that's been with us for, you know, since we've been tracking respiratory viruses. It's very, very common. And we think of it typically during the typical respiratory season. It follows the same pattern as influenza, where it starts up in about September, October, lasts through the Christmas season, starts declining between January and February, but it is very, very common. And in the post-COVID era, it's probably the third most common virus we isolate from people as we track viruses in the community.
Who's at the greatest risk of the most severe symptoms of RSV?
So the traditional patient for RSV was actually the youngest of the young child. And you know, for those of us who are parents, who've had to unfortunately deal with this situation, it can really affect young children with very delicate airways. The other population that's actually at greatest risk is those over the age of 65. And repeatedly, you know, those are the two groups we see that are hospitalized with RSV the most. The young kids end up doing pretty well when they get hospitalized. They, you know, they're sick, but they recover. Those older folks don't necessarily do as well. And in fact, the largest group that dies of RSV is those over the age of 65 and with other medical conditions.
Okay. And what are the longer term effects of the virus?
So, you know, obviously being sick and having a respiratory syndrome is not great, especially in certain populations. But as we're learning more about what viruses can do and kind of their multi-system effects, we do know that viruses also have effects outside of just the respiratory tract. The inflammation and some of the even direct effects of these viruses can actually affect the heart. And so patients who have heart issues can be at increased risk of a heart attack or heart failure after getting RSV. People who are frail who end up sick with RSV may end up even frailer. And those with underlying lung conditions, even though they may recover, their lung conditions can actually worsen after their RSV infection. So it's not simply just a week or two of getting worse. You know, there may be some permanent damage from these infections as they happen.
How effective is the vaccine in protecting people, particularly the groups that you identified as having higher risk?
So there are two vaccines that are available and one that's approved but not on the market. You know, the clinical trials for these vaccines suggested that they were up to 80% effective in preventing people from getting sick with RSV. They're even better at preventing people from getting hospitalized with RSV. And the nice thing is both of these vaccines have been followed for 2 to 3 years, and we're still seeing that 70 to 80% protection being offered by those vaccines in the clinical trials, as well as in real world data, as they've been on the market now for about 3 years, seeing that kind of 60 to 80% protection in a number of different databases in the United States and globally as the vaccine has been more widely implemented.
Is this the type of vaccine where it requires sort of blanket protection for it to protect everybody? Or is it if you get the vaccine, you receive that level of protection?
Yeah, I would say it's more individual protection. The kind of population level effects are still being determined. There is some, you know, interesting data from places that are doing more widespread vaccination, like the United Kingdom, where they may have actually seen populations having shifts. Mind you, we are giving this vaccine only to certain populations, recognizing, again, it's for that individual protection. And so, you know, there is still going to be RSV transmitting in the environment. It really is to protect those people at the highest risk from ending up with the complications of RSV that land them in hospital or destabilize their underlying diseases.
Can you
take the vaccine or receive the vaccine if you have RSV or if you've had RSV recently?
Yeah, so the vaccine is really there to prevent that infection. Now, RSV is very common, and most people will be infected several times through life. Most kids get it by the age of 3 months of 3 years of age. And so it's very common that people, you know, in 65 and older have probably seen RSV a few times. We don't test for RSV very often, so people don't know if that virus they got in the winter is influenza, RSV, or a number of other viruses. And so, you know, we would be giving the vaccine to people who have not had RSV recently. But if one has had RSV, you theoretically could still get the vaccine after a certain amount of time just to let the system calm down and to get the optimal protection now that your immune system is kind of forgetting about the RSV it saw before.
So off the top, I had mentioned that the Ontario government has expanded the program to provide the vaccine for people 75 and older. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I'm very happy that it's being provided for a certain group. The Ontario government followed the National Advisory Committee on Immunization, our federal vaccine steering group, that really had recommended to the provinces, if they were to fund vaccines, that 75-year-old target was higher. It is a little bit confusing, as the vaccine is actually approved for 60 and over, and the Arexvy vaccine is actually approved for certain populations, even 50 to 59. But when we do more kind of health systems analysis, trying to see where the biggest bang for the buck is, the National Advisory Committee on Immunization said, well, you know, a mass vaccine campaign in 75-year-olds is probably going to derive the most health system benefits for the cost. And so that's where that number came from. So glad it's there. There are other publicly funded programs that are looking across the country to kind of replicate this. And really, you know, Ontario hopefully is the leader in making sure that vulnerable populations, including those over 75, have access to this vaccine as part of their prevention.
So what is driving the decision of 75 being the cutoff? Is it a function of cost or cost efficiency based on results, or what do you think is driving it?
So there's the National Advisory Committee on Immunization, again, the federal working group on vaccines, looked at, you know, cost per age group and kind of different modeled scenarios of giving it to 60-year-olds, 65-year-olds, 70-year-olds, 75-year-olds. And again, you know, there's complex pharmacoeconomic principles in this, but really seeing that the cost per dollar of vaccine in terms of preventing hospitalizations, preventing serious complications, was highest in those 75-year-olds and up. It does not mean a 60-year-old can't derive the benefit from getting a vaccine. The clinical trials actually did show that. It really is where, you know, in a publicly funded system where we have only a certain amount to invest, where the largest reward is going to be. And that's where that 75-year-old population is derived from.
Okay. But presumably, like I'm not 60 yet, but if I wanted the vaccine, I could get it. It's just not free, right? I would have to pay for it. Isn't that?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And again, the clinical trial showed that even 60-year-olds and even some 50 to 59-year-olds, you know, derive some benefit from this vaccine. It's not as profound as a 75-year-old, but there were still individual benefits seen. And absolutely, those vaccines, they've been accessible for the last 3 years on the current market for individuals where it's indicated to where they, you know, where they're able to acquire the vaccine and take it, you know, they would have to pay for it, but you know, it is completely accessible for them to get it from a pharmacy.
Is there a particular cohort of people under the age of 75 that have a pre-existing condition that makes it perhaps more important that they might consider getting the vaccine? Like, is it somebody, if you're immune compromised, I'm thinking, or if you have something else going on, like, does the science support certain groups who should get it?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we look at, you know, large data series of who gets hospitalized with RSV, most people do have a comorbidity. The ones that show up the most, as you said, people who are immunocompromised, people with underlying lung disease, so moderate asthma, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or other lung conditions, people with heart disease, people with diabetes, people with chronic kidney disease, And certain other individuals, particularly frail individuals, where having respiratory infections is not ideal, you know, those are the populations where in that 60 to 75 year old age group may want to really consider this as part of their prevention plan. And I think one thing I didn't mention and you know, is relevant is this is only a one dose vaccine for now. There are studies ongoing on when to do the next dose. But for now, at least for 3 years of data, there's no recommendation to revaccinate. So people are getting persistent protection over time from getting a single dose of a vaccine, which really does increase that benefit profile of getting it, you know, as a single injection that lasts some time.
Oh, so it's different than the flu vaccine where, there's each year there's like a different focus on a different cause, right? Like, you know, they try and get ahead of the curve, they anticipate where it's going, and you should be getting one every year. But this is different. This is a one-shot deal.
Yeah, this is different. RSV is a much more stable virus. So it's kind of what's circulating year to year is pretty similar. And so this is why this vaccine likely has that kind of stable effect to linger in the population longer, which is really good because again, it's important to get, but it's not necessarily that you have to do it every year. It's really a one-time opportunity now as we kind of figure out when the next vaccine comes.
Okay, so if we carved out the issue of cost, really, I guess theoretically, then everybody over the age of what, 60 should be getting this vaccine? Right?
Like absolutely. Like I think, you know, the clinical trials show benefit in those over 60. The people with underlying conditions probably benefit more than those over 60. And so that's really a good discussion with your provider to say, hey, you know, given my history, is this something I should do? So because of longevity, you know, many people may hesitate to get a vaccine saying, well, I should probably get it when I'm older, when I'll benefit the most, you know, recognizing this vaccine actually lasts for some time. People can make that decision early, you know, to get the benefits today rather than waiting in the future to get the benefits tomorrow.
That makes sense. Do you have any final thoughts to share regarding RSV?
Yeah, I think people, you know, should be aware. Please, you know, contact your providers, ask about this, really recognize that this is a virus. There's a huge amount of information about COVID and influenza, but this is kind of the one that's been left behind. And it's really exciting because we have great solutions for adults. I didn't talk about it much, but we have great solutions for young children too. And hopefully this is actually a viral target we can try to keep out of the hospital and let people recover from in the community with very mild illnesses.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
No problem. All the best and thanks for having me.
That was Dr. Zane Shagla. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss the risks of missing the signs of reproductive cancer on The Tonic.
For over 40 years, the Big Carrot has been the community's go-to for fresh, local, and organic goodness. As a worker-owned natural food market, the Big Carrot is all about healthy living, sustainability, and bringing people together. They've got everything you need, from vibrant produce and bulk goodies to natural body care and wellness advice to keep you feeling amazing. And their kitchen and juice bars, serving up deliciousness every single day. Now, as they celebrate 41 incredible years, they're inviting everyone to join the fun. Head to thebigcarrot.ca to discover more, and follow them on Instagram at The Big Carrot for a chance to win big in their anniversary giveaways.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Dr. Jessica McAlpin is a BC cancer surgeon scientist practicing at the Vancouver General Hospital and division co-head of gynecologic oncology at the University of British Columbia. Welcome to the show, Dr. McAlpin. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
So today we're going to discuss the signs of reproductive cancer and what the risks are of missing those signs. But in order to have that conversation, I think we should probably identify what are reproductive or gynecological cancers.
Yeah, I think what we're focusing on here are cancers of the uterus, ovary, cervix, vulva, and vagina.
According to a peer-reviewed study in the Canadian Medical Association Journal, endometrial cancer is the most common of the gynecological cancers, with an estimated 8,600 women diagnosed last year. My understanding is that incident rates have been on the rise for decades. Why is it that endometrial cancer is a growing issue?
Yeah, it's a tough question in some ways. Unquestionably, this cancer is increasing in incidence and actually on a trajectory to be second only to breast cancer within the next decade. There are some factors, aging population, less likely that women are undergoing hysterectomy, so removing the organ in question. And there's also obviously increasing obesity in the majority of developed nations, but that's one type of sort of obesity-driven, estrogen-driven endometrial cancer. There are other types of endometrial cancer that are also increasing that we don't have a great answer for why.
So you identified age and obesity are the leading factors impacting gynecological cancers. What are the other risks? Is it hereditary in some circumstances?
Yeah, it's a good question. Hereditary or familial factors do play a role in some, particularly fallopian tube ovarian cancers and some types of endometrial cancer. So having good conversations about family members and understanding ages and what cancers people have can help alert to that. There's also cancers that are related to human papillomavirus, a very common, near ubiquitous virus in anyone with any sort of sexual activity. And HPV is a huge role in cervical cancer and also an important role in vulvar cancers. And, you know, vaccinating children, grandchildren, talking about it with motivated adults can have a big impact on those gynecologic cancers as well as roles in head, neck, and anal cancer. So HPV is something we can tackle together.
So what are some of the gynecological cancer concerns that you're seeing within your practice specifically?
It's a challenge. You know, we have such an amazing healthcare system at so many levels in terms of options for access to screening tests and, you know, many services that are provided free. But unfortunately, I still see patients that have not had screening and present with advanced cancers, obviously hugely frustrating knowing that we could have intervened earlier and cured the cancer. So I think aspects of education, conversations, understanding what should bring you to the attention of your family doctor, helping encourage our friends and grannies and aunties to do this is really an opportunity to be impactful and hopefully change that.
My understanding is that there's a national survey conducted by Leger Research, commissioned by GSK, which revealed that nearly 60% of Canadian women who were surveyed were uncertain whether gynecological cancers present early warning signs. Are you surprised by that?
Yeah, I am. And then maybe I'm not, because maybe it depends which type of cancer. We have some cancers of the gynecologic organs, like ovarian cancer, where there aren't clear symptoms or warning signs to hang your hat on. Often very nonspecific, vague bloating, change in bowel or bladder habits, and often get missed until that cancer presents at a more advanced stage. But there are other symptoms that are much more obvious, and I hope will herald, you know, women to go and seek attention and to ask questions, and that can be bleeding or spotting and otherwise. But I think, you know, in general, again, it comes back to communication, having a comfort level, maybe talking about things that are sometimes less comfortable, these cancers below the belt, or feeling that you can't discuss bleeding, spotting, discomfort. I think things that are sometimes either new or persistent or worsening really should, I guess, empower us to talk more about it. And again, to try and seek attention or answers for those things.
So let's focus for a moment on the early signs. So you mentioned spotting and bleeding. And I guess my question to you are, what are the common, perhaps less common, early risk signs? And are those signs sometimes confused for what might be something else going on down there?
Yeah, for sure. I think that there's a million reasons where people can feel a little bit of bloating or discomfort or changes in a day. I think that there are perhaps more obvious times in a postmenopausal woman where no bleeding or abnormal, you know, discharge should be ignored and should bring to attention harder when you're before the age of menopause or perimenopause, and you may have irregular bleeding, but still can warrant discussions. We've talked about some of these things in terms of bloating, change in bowel or bladder habits, pain, bleeding, discharge. Sometimes from the outside, there can be symptoms, so vulvar itching, masses, irritation. I think that those are often ignored with creams and topicals. Having someone take a look, having someone take a biopsy, if you're not sure, always can get more information. So I think those cover the symptoms, and you've asked good questions about them. But again, I think new, persistent, worsening for any of those should still maybe strike a chord that something's not quite right. And people, I think, do know their bodies and what's different.
Okay. I guess it's difficult, right? As a layperson, I'm not a doctor. So when you talk about these symptoms and, you know, having them for a day, that's one thing. And you know, sort of describing them as persistent or worsening, but that's sort of very nebulous, right? That's very subjective. And so, like, do you have a rule of thumb when women should perhaps be consulting their doctors when some of these symptoms come about?
How long something goes on, yeah. I guess if it's weeks, yeah. I think that's enough. Weeks of worsening or persistence. And, you know, there's been, again, it just depends on the type of symptoms. Bloating and vague things in the abdominal cavity are tough, I agree.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, we're frustrated with things that don't have good screening, like ovarian cancer and otherwise. But there's other things, again, like bleeding or lumps or bumps that are visualized or palpated that I think can be drawing attention more urgently and more of a discussion within weeks, because we know that they shouldn't arise. So I think it depends. Talk about it with your friends, try to talk about it with your physician, and let them reassure you that actually it's okay.
Okay. And forgive my ignorance, but like, do you think that an average GP is equipped to deal with this, or should women be making appointments with their gynecologist in order to have this properly vetted?
Yeah, great question. I have tremendous respect for my colleagues in family practice. I think the diversity of care they are providing is certainly challenging, from everything from heart medications, mental health, to these gynecologic symptoms. But I do feel they're equipped, and I think they're going to be fantastic at assessing, at obtaining biopsies when need, and when they're not comfortable of redirecting. And we really encourage our family practitioners to pick up the phone and talk with a GYN oncologist. If they think there's a cancer, they don't have to go through a general gynecologist. And those conversations can be really helpful and guiding to make sure the right workup's done and to reduce, you know, weeks of waiting or, you know, unnecessary delays for our patients. So I think they're equipped and fantastic, and maybe with a bit of dialogue and support, we can guide further.
So I cited a survey a few questions back. That same survey found that 85% of the respondents wanted their doctors to initiate conversations about gynecological health. So, you know, what should those discussions look like? And are doctors doing that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not sure I've got the answer for everybody. And I like to think and hope that there are physicians talking about this. But again, as we all know, there's sometimes limited time and a list that your GP may ask you to focus on in a day. I guess I hope that they'll be encompassing conversations about knowing your own body and an open-ended question at the end of every visit to ask patients if there's anything that they're uncomfortable with or experiencing that they want to talk further on. Again, I think also asking, you know, having patients talk with each other and with their women in their lives, friends, aunties, grandparents, grandkids, about these things as well can also help.
From your perspective, what are the biggest misconceptions or stigmas surrounding gynecological cancers?
Yeah, I think that I guess a stigma or concern would be that it's not okay to talk about gynecologic organs. These are parts of us and can be normalized from kids to any age. That symptoms like bleeding or pain in gynecologic organs are somehow embarrassing. They're not. Everybody's going to be talking or dealing about these things, and I hope it could be an open conversation. Or maybe, I guess I'd worry if they thought there was something that couldn't be done, or it was a doom and gloom if a cancer is diagnosed, because we actually have many cancers that we can cure with surgery or other early interventions. And so, you know, pushing to get that diagnosis and come to see us sooner is always good.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
I really appreciate it. Cheers and thanks.
Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Dr. Gordon Chang, Marcy Westcott, Dr. Zane Chagla, and Dr. Jessica McAlpin. And thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you can always follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic newsletter. Now distributed once a week, The Tonic newsletter, with content curated personally by me, will keep you in the loop. There's contests, prizes, insider scoops, and so much more. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you're interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you can always email me at jamie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.